Fifth number 6229, reel 1.
Mrs. Colley, reel 1. To start with, Mrs. Colley, tell me a little bit about your home and your family, where you were brought up, what your general childhood background was.
I have two sisters, three sisters I had then, nobody had done teaching, but it was considered to be a very safe thing for me to go in for. And I'd always, as a child, about 7 or 8, I'd always wanted to teach. In fact, by the time I was 13, I was being made use of in the school I attended to take the place of any teachers who were away. I was always pushed in to take the class, which seems now, looking back on it, very strange, but however, they did. By the time I was 14, I was still at an ordinary church school, actually.
Where was this?
In Bromley in Kent. Although I was born in London, but we'd gone to London when I was about 11, and I was attending this little church school, and I was still there by the time I was 14. Unfortunately, the headmistress felt that I was going to be wasted because there was no chance at all of my going in for teaching as far as my parents were concerned. They couldn't possibly afford it. So she, fortunately for me, did her best to get me into the local secondary school, which was grammar school, we'd call it now. And so I got there, and then I went on and took matriculation, the usual entrance exams for college, and I was trained at Goldsmiths College at New Cross, which was a teacher's training college, still is a teacher's training college. And that was only a 2-year course in those days. And then when I finished my course in 26, and at that time, which you wouldn't remember, things were extremely difficult, and there were very few teaching jobs available, and everybody was applying all over the place to try and get jobs, and jobs were very difficult to obtain. So among other things, I saw there was a notice on the college notice board asking for volunteers to teach in the army. And along with all my other applications, a friend and I, we put in an application to go into the army, not knowing a thing about it, actually. That was the first interview we got, as it happened, although we'd applied to many other places, but that was the first interview we had, and we were asked to attend War Office and so on. And I didn't think I would stand a chance because none of my family had an army background, and they really preferred people who had some connection with the army. But I think, apart from the fact that all the civilian schools were crying out for few teaching posts, the army apparently needed people, and they did want to get fresh blood in from the colleges because as you probably know by now, a lot of the teachers, first of all in the army, were army trained. They had a sort of training department at Aldershot where they trained people themselves to go into the army schools, and then they came out of there not being recognised by the local education authorities, but they were qualified to teach in the army. And for some reason, the army decided that they needed people in who were trained by the outside colleges and who had teaching certificates. And we were, I think, about the first intake from outside. And they offered me a job. Well, I couldn't turn it down. And I didn't want to. I thought, well, there was a chance to travel, which they'd offered me, and I'd always wanted to travel. And it seemed just the answer to everything. I'd got a job, and I'd got the possibility of travelling.
Did you have additional training after you had joined the QAS, or were you deemed to be fully qualified?
The qualifications were even better than they had, because we were college-trained and accepted by... We had Board of Education teaching certificate. Mm. Which later on the army teachers had to obtain externally if they wanted to get the higher rate of pay, because when we switched over to be recognised, then these people were not given certificated rates of pay because they were regarded as untrained, although they had actually a very good training at this place in Aldershot. I must say those I met were excellent teachers. I've got nothing whatever against the training they had. They had very good training. But it was just that it wasn't recognised by the Board of Education. So they took an external exam.
Just one detail. When you went to the secondary school, did you go there on a scholarship or did your parents pay for you?
No, I had a bursarship, which I didn't understand at the time, but which I think must have accounted for the fees, except we had to pay half fees, I think. And they that accounted for the rest of the fees because it was really fee-paying. And I'd got beyond the stage of obtaining a scholarship because that was at 11 years old. I'd taken the scholarship exam in London before I left London. And although I passed that, there was another interview to come, which would have been an oral examination. After you passed the written one, you had to go for an oral. Well, by the time the oral one came up, I'd moved into Bromley, which was in Kent in those days. It wasn't a London borough. It was in Kent. And so London washed their hands of me and said, oh, well, if you've moved, that's it, you see. So I stood no chance after that. You got one chance at a scholarship, and that was it.
Yes.
And so I passed that stage.
So when you got this bursarship, I presume that your parents had to pay for a proportion of
They paid
expenses.
Half, as far as I can remember.
Was that much of a financial burden?
Oh, it was a terrible struggle. It was so much of a struggle that my sisters and even a friend contributed sixpence a week towards this, and they solemnly gave in a sixpence a week, which is a half a crown among the five of them. And this was, mother accumulated this to pay this half fee. It was a very, very great struggle for them, and which, you know, I felt at the time was wrong that I should have allowed them to do this, but they were so keen. My mother was very keen on education. She felt that education was the thing, and she wanted us all to have something in our hands by which we could earn our living. This was a great thing with mother because they had had to struggle, and she realised the thing to do was to have something which was going to be certain to bring you in a livelihood. And, well, I appreciate it very much. Looking back, I appreciate it even more with hindsight.
What was your father's employment?
Well, he was a house decorator, actually. But, of course, you know, employment was hit and miss. He never had really a settled income. I can remember now that they puzzled over the form they had to fill in for me to go to the secondary school when I was applying for this place. And, it said how much yearly income. And I know the family got together and puzzled this out. And they thought, well, if he got £100 a year, it was as much as he did get, and probably not as much as that. But I know they put down £100 a year, which even in 1926 wasn't very much. Although my sisters by that time had left home because they were much older than I was. My next sister is 8 years old and the next one is 10 years older and the other one was 17 years older. So they were grown up, you see, and they'd left home by then.
Yes. Now, I know after you joined QAS, your first appointments from 26 to 37 were at UK Army schools, and then in 1937, you had your first overseas post.
Well, of course, I went to Germany, only that wasn't considered overseas. I taught with the British Army of the Rhine. Only to me, it was going overseas, it was abroad, but to them, it was home service.
Yes.
And after I went there, after just a few months in Aldershot, I did a few months in Aldershot, and then I was straightway in the September term. And by the end of October, I was on the Rhine. And so I went to I was on the Rhine for about 2.5 years. And that took me, then I came home again. By that time, I'd married. And then I came home and, what did we do? We went to Aldershot. No, we went straight to Gibraltar, that's right. We just came home from the Rhine, had about a month's leave, and then we went to Gibraltar. And so that was considered abroad, but the Rhine wasn't.
And when you went to Singapore in 1937, was that an appointment you were expecting?
We applied for it, actually.
Why?
Well, you could do these things. You could, if you put got in early and you had a choice, you know, and pulled a few strings. Not for me, from my husband's point of view. And we decided that this would be rather nice to go to far east. We didn't want to, for some reason, I can't think now, but we didn't want to go to India. And we were always afraid that if we hesitated too long, we might get to India. So in order to forestall this, we decided on Singapore. And we I can't remember how it worked, but I know, I think my husband got a posting and then I applied because he'd got a posting. And I suppose there was a vacancy. I really am very hazy about that. But I know we sort of picked out Singapore because we didn't want to go to India.
Mr. Colley's business was what? Was he in the
Army?
He
was in the Army. I met him in the Army. He was in the RASC and I met him on the Rhine.
Nice. Mm. Yes. Now, you had 2 years in... No, you had 4 years in Singapore before the outbreak of war.
Yes. Mm.
What was life like in Singapore during peacetime?
Well, it was wonderful. I liked it. I wasn't disturbed by the heat or the humidity, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. There was plenty of social life. I'm not terribly keen on that myself, but I mean, it was there. It wasn't like, we were in a nicely situated place near the town. We were in Fort Canning, which is above the town, looked down onto the town, and we had a very nice quarter. We had good servants, and I just taught in the mornings only. My bus collected me at 7 o'clock, and I was home about 1:30. We taught the whole morning. It was a very long morning, but we did mornings only. And then they built us a new school from the first one I went to, and I went there. And then I was posted later on to Changi, famous Changi, and my husband by that time was commissioned. And so we were given an officer's quarter in Changi, which almost overlooked the famous jail. We could see it anyway from our veranda. And... yes, it was very pleasant indeed. As I say, I liked it, but we thought, we really was a 3-year station, and so we had anticipated only staying there 3 years. But of course, by that time the war had broken out, and we knew that we didn't stand any chance. And what they did then was to start sending home people who'd been there the longest. And we'd only been there by the time the war broke out, you see, a couple of years. And then when things started to get difficult, we still were fairly low on the list because some people had been there as much as 7 years. And they were pushing them home first because, of course, it was considered in those days that the climate wasn't suitable for a longer stay than 3 years, which, of course, amused me after I'd spent 8 years there in this same climate. But... you know, that this was the idea in the army, that Gibraltar was a 5-year station, but Singapore and places like that were only 3 years, and a place like Aden was only 1 year because they considered the climate and so on wasn't suitable. So 3 years, and we stayed and stayed on. We didn't expect to be sent home at the moment, but we did expect eventually that we would get home.
Mm. What was the impact of the outbreak of the European War in 1939 on Singapore? Do you remember it?
Well, it didn't. Well, of course, I suppose we were so far away that we were shocked and worried about our folk at home. I think my main concern always was what was happening to my family. And I was extremely worried about them and having letters from them and so on about what was going on. And I was very worried and felt quite helpless to be out there and rather guilty about being out there having such an easy time when they obviously were having a pretty bad time. But apart from that, and apart from very, very few shortages of things that we had normally had sent out from home, we didn't notice it at all. There was made no impact as far as that went.
None at all.
Couldn't get drinks from France, and So we were having to get them from South Africa and Australia, and we didn't think the Australian drinks were very good. But you know, I mean, really, it didn't affect us at all, I must say. And as I say, I have felt quite guilty about it. I felt I was lotus eating almost while they were in a bad way.
At what stage did war make some direct impact on Singapore?
I don't think it did until right at the end, until the bombing shocked us into realisation. Because when the two big ships came out and we saw them go by, it looked as if things were, you know, moving a bit to see these ships coming in. And, of course, we were aware that more troops were coming in. But it didn't really have a great deal. We did start stocking up as far as we were concerned personally. I had no intention of leaving, and we were stocking up for a siege, and I had masses and masses of food for us against a siege, tinned food, provisions, and things that would keep indefinitely. I remember we had blocks and blocks and blocks of chocolate, you know, that very hard, plain chocolate. Goodness knows where it came from. Thought that would sustain us, you see, and all sorts of things that we thought would be sustaining, and, as I say, tinned food, all the sort of provisions that we could possibly have, salt, which we thought we shouldn't get any of, and tea and that sort of thing that we stocked up. We had masses and masses of provisions. I could have had enough for 3 months, quite 3 months, to withstand a siege. And we rather, as we realised things were blowing up, we had this siege mentality. We thought, well, we'll probably be besieged. This is what will happen. But we never, of course, thought, nobody dreamt or dared say that Singapore would... Well, after all, it was boosted as an impregnable fortress. We rather believed it. Mm. I mean, all those in high command seemed to believe it too. And it just took us completely by surprise that... and, of course, we didn't realise that the Air Force was so thin on the ground, which it was. And we didn't... of course, nobody... you must have read it in the books that nobody expected an attack by land. We thought any attack would come by sea, which was the way the guns were pointing. Everything was... settled for a siege, you see. Yes. We could hold out.
Did you start stockpiling before the Japanese declaration of war? Stockpiling the food.
Did we stop doing it?
Did you start doing it before the Japanese declaration of war?
Yes, I think we did. I think
so
we
there
did.
Was
we rather, you know, things were sort of getting a little bit chancy, I think. And yes, I'm sure we started before then.
So there was some sense of there being a threat from the Japanese.
It was very strange, one thing, which is really very strange, I think. I had an armour and a cook boy. And the armour I'd had for years, I'd had her with me when I first went to Singapore. And I took her with me when we went to Changi. And I was very fond of her. And she was a dear little girl. And as things gradually got difficult, the military authorities said that all the servants working in military quarters had to have passes with their photographs on. And this was well before the Japanese outbreak. And so I told my armor that she'd have to get her photograph taken and that she would have to have a pass. They would stop her otherwise. And... she didn't say anything, but the next day I said I would arrange for her to have the photograph taken, and she refused. And she said, no, I can't do that, Missy. My cousins say no. Well, you know, they were in Kongses, which are sort of groups, and they always call them their cousins. They weren't really, but they're sort of little group, and they all call them, no, my Kongses say, my cousins say, I mustn't do it. So I said, but why on earth? I said, if you don't get a pass... I can't employ you anymore. You'll lose your job. And this went on back and forth for days, and it was getting desperate because I had to get this pass for her. And eventually I said, well, look, you must tell your cousins that it's perfectly all right. And she said, and I said, why not? And she said, when Japanese come, anybody who works for the British. Now, that was before there was any thought of the Japanese coming, and this was a Chinese armour, which I think was... They knew more about what was going to happen than we did. We're sitting there, you know, in a fool's paradise, but they'd got more sense than we had.
That's very interesting.
Yes. Yes. I thought it was, it was absolutely incredible. No, goodness, she did this right,
right across her throat.
Yes, she said, no, when Japanese come, I said, the Japanese are not coming. What are you talking about? Of course the Japanese are not coming. I thought of that many times afterwards. Yeah.
When did the scales finally fall from your eyes?
Well, I think just when the bombing came. I mean, that was absolutely took us completely by surprise. And all the lights were blaring all over Singapore. It was a blaze of lights. We'd never had to douse any lights, of course. And the prison had four searchlights, one on each corner. And we were overlooking the prison. And, I mean, it was wonderful. There was everything, absolutely a blaze of light. And the planes had only got to follow the lights, which they did, of course. And even then, nobody thought of putting... I think we were so stunned that people even then didn't think immediately of dousing the lights. They were still blazing away as the bombs were dropping and went on dropping, but the lights still blazed. Because everybody was so taken aback that they'd had no drilling or no idea what to do in such an emergency. And there was no preparation at all. Of course, next day all the preparation started, digging trenches and so on and so forth. And but it took the bombing to absolutely, you know, make us aware that there was really something serious afoot.
So before the bombing, there were no significant preparations?
No, none at all, no. Except, as I say, we did have some more troops. More troops seemed to be getting more troops landing.
And after the bombing, how then did the pattern of events begin to affect you personally?
Well, I started losing a lot of the children by degrees, were missing from school. And we were told after eventually to have a suitcase ready, packed and ready, one suitcase, in case we were asked to go. But we were not allowed, nobody was allowed to talk about an evacuation. And this, I think, was very wrong, but they didn't want to disturb the morale of the civilian population, because obviously... If they'd talked about evacuating all the military personnel and all the British people, and it looked as if we were going to abandon them to their fate, and after all, you know, this was a pretty rough thing to say we were going to do, so they wouldn't talk about evacuation, even though it would have only affected the women, but they didn't even, they just said that people who wanted to go could go, and they provided transport for people with children, first of all, so people with children were just told quietly that they'd better go and get out, but not evacuated. It was a choice, you see, they could go, the transport was there. So gradually, the women with children, of course, naturally went out. And at the beginning, there was a choice. People could choose to go to Australia or go to India or go home to England. Or, you know, there was a fair amount of choice at first. But I didn't ask to go. I felt I would never ask to go. If it was an evacuation, I would go. But I felt I would never ask to go. I hadn't any children. And the headmaster of the school was taken away to do cipher work in the headquarters, and I was left running the school, and I thought that eventually when the children had gone they would take me in to do cipher work as well. I mean, I'm quite as capable as he was, I thought, of learning to do cipher work, and I quite thought that I could be useful, you know. I had this sort of stupid sense of duty. I can be useful, you know, I can do something useful here. And, of course, still expecting only a siege. And it didn't work out that way.
What was it like at school? with this rundown going on?
Well, of course, first of all, there were quite a number of us, and we had slit trenches, just about enough slit trenches to accommodate the children. And so the Japs were very strange. They, I think it's a queer mentality they have, but they used to come regularly at 8:30 every morning to bomb. And so we started school at 8:00, and we would rush into school, call the register, take prayers, give the children something to do, books and so on, and be sure they'd got pencils and papers. And we'd all march solemnly into the trenches and sit there. And then, sure as fate, the planes came over at 8:30. And we'd wait until we thought they'd all gone. And then we'd nip back into the classrooms probably for about an hour before the dinner break. And this went on day after day after day. But, of course, as I say, the children, we tried to, we'd got just forms in the trenches. We'd sit the children on those and try to take something with them to take their minds off it. But as I said in my article for the QAS, that the ants worried the children more than the bombs. They were being bitten by these huge ants, and there was a terrible difficulty to keep them in the trenches because they would much rather have been out on... Not that we did actually at that time get any bombs, but later on Changi was bombed. But I stayed there until there were only three children left. And then I wrote to, sent a message into the headquarters and said, I have only three children left. Have I permission to close the school? And their reply was, we didn't know you were there. We didn't know the school was still open. Didn't even know I was there. And I was the last one there. Nobody knew I was there. Because Changi was well out from, 15 miles out from the headquarters. They thought I'd gone. All the other school mistresses had gone. They thought I'd gone. And I was sitting there with three children. So they said, yes, close it, but they didn't send for me and ask me to go in or anything like that.
Apart from school, what other impact did the war have on you and your husband and your home life, for example?
Well, of course, he was constantly called out to do all sorts of things. When the Prince of Wales and the Renown was sunk, of course, he was RASC, so he had to go down and arrange accommodation for these fellows who were being brought in from the sea to make sure they'd got accommodation, beds and blankets and all this sort of thing. And he was back and forth. I never knew whether he was going to be into meals or anything else, and we were just scrapping along. Social life, of course, was at an end. I didn't see my friends, although my friend at the mental hospital, a nurse, used to come out occasionally in the car. She was very worried about me, and eventually I went to her because Changi was a military objective, and they dropped leaflets to say they were going to bomb Changi and shatter it, and this was a military objective. And life just ticked on. I got some refugees from Penang, because Penang went first, of course. And so some people we knew came down, flooding into Singapore to before they were put on ships. And they were given priority on the shipping because they hadn't got a home. Once they were out of Penang, their homes were gone. So they were given priority on the ships to take them home. And we had this woman, well, over the Christmas, actually. And she was in a terrible state of nerves because she'd experienced the bombing in Penang. And people coming out. It was extraordinary. Now, her husband had been up country, and he came down to see her from up country, and he brought all sorts of stuff, perfume and all sorts of things from the shops that had been bombed and were being looted and so on. And my husband was the same. He went out to the naval base, and he brought home a whole heap of it really struck me as being, at the time, incredible. I couldn't think why I should want to pile the house up with things that he'd salvaged from the naval base. I couldn't care less whether I had all these things being brought in.
What sort of things?
Oh, china and glass and things like that. And he said when he went to the naval base, after they'd evacuated the naval base, he said there were revolvers and rifles and things hanging there. They'd just walked out and left things there. It was just... They'd left all the, even this rifles and ammunition there, which must have been very wrong. I doubt if many people knew that that had happened because, I mean, obviously the thing to do would have been to either take them or at least make sure that they couldn't be used again. But there they were for anybody to walk in and use, which probably the Japs did when they got in. It was incredible. Things like that. I think, as I say, people, they were so unprepared. Nobody was prepared for it, and you know, it took everybody by surprise. I'm sure they did all sorts of foolish things because we hadn't been prepared, and there were Shenton Thomas and all these people telling us not to panic and not to allow the civilian population's morale to fall and all this sort of thing. And anybody could see what was happening. I was very amused when the Queen Mary went through. They knew the Queen Mary, she was carrying troops then. Our school was right on the water, and we saw the Queen Mary come in, and we took the children down to see her. And the troops were waving to us from the decks. And the education officer came out from the headquarters, and he was talking to the children. He said, "Did you see the big ship come in?" And they said, "Oh, yes, well, the Queen Mary." And he said, "Shh. The 504. You mustn't mention the name." Now, it was all over Singapore. All Singapore knew it was the Queen Mary. All the children knew it was the Queen Mary. It was obviously the Queen Mary. It certainly didn't have its name on then. But, you know, this was the sort of thing. They still thought that people were entirely ignorant of what was going on. They just thought that nobody was peeping behind the scenes, that they could blanket us all, and we didn't know and we didn't make inquiries, you know. Was so absurd.
Hmm. At what stage did evacuation for you become a probability?
Well, we were told to keep this suitcase packed, which I did, with things suitable for England, because I was determined that if I was going to be sent anywhere, I would come home, because I felt that my family were here. I should be with them no matter what. That I wasn't going to lead any more years, you know, lotus eating, that I should be at home. And so I got all sorts of warm clothes. I'd been knitting madly, and I packed all this and as much as I could into one huge suitcase. And so that was ready. And